Dr. William F. Pepper is a barrister, a member of the Bar of England and Wales, attorney at law admitted to a number of federal and state bars in the U.S. He convened the Seminar on International Human Rights at Oxford University, England. He was a journalist in Vietnam who convinced Martin Luther King, a friend and associate of Martin Luther King, to formalize his opposition to the war, which he did on April 4, 1967, in MLK's historic speech at Riverside Church. He worked closely with Martin Luther King the last year of his life and ran the 1960s movement umbrella organization, the National Conference for New Politics, at Martin Luther King's request. Subsequently, he investigated the MLK assassination for 25 years, became convinced of James Earl Ray's innocence, and became his lawyer for the last 10 years of his life, taking the quest for a trial to the U.S. Supreme Court, and then represented the family of MLK, bringing a civil case against conspirators with the case tried in Memphis in 1999. So 30 days, it took 30 days, that case, bringing 70 witnesses, resulting in a verdict for the King family and the jury confirming the existence of a conspiracy involving the U.S. government in the assassination of Martin Luther King. If you haven't read it yet, there's a book called Orders to Kill, which William Pepper wrote, which delineates the particulars of that case. He's the author of 5 books, 2 on the MLK case, and numerous articles. He's involved currently as counsel in international human rights cases, has represented a number of sovereign states and heads of state, and is a close personal friend and advisor to Hugo Chavez Frias, president of Venezuela. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to bring you William Pepper.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here with you again. I bring you greetings from Ed Asner, who is recovering a double hip replacement, and through Ed Asner, from many of your friends in the entertainment industry who wish you well with your work. Your work is well received. You have many friends out in that industry and certainly in that part of the country, and Ed wanted me to convey their best wishes and good thoughts to you and all of you. I also bring you greetings from Nicolas Maduro, who is the new foreign minister of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Nicolas, as some of you know, met with a couple of your associates in Caracas. He has one of the largest 9/11 libraries in the world, and it's become a very a major interest of his. When I saw him in London at a luncheon for the president that was given by Ken Livingston, he pulled me aside and said, what do you think about all of this 9/11 stuff? He said, what do you think is going on there? And I said, Nicholas, you have to keep due diligence and open mind and know that there are friends of this republic working very hard to get the truth out about 9/11. So I think you'll be hearing more and more from Nicolas Maduro over the years on this issue because he has a good deal of interest in it. And certainly he, as well as I, to the extent possible, will let the president know about it. As you know, Hugo Chavez Frias is not one of the favorite pieces of work with this government, and he is about, as is Venezuela in my view, to become a member of the Security Council of the United Nations against the objections of the United States. And I suggest that defeat for the United States will be one of the most ignominious defeats that this country has ever suffered before the General Assembly of the United Nations. Now, I leave a box here for you, and this is not the main purpose of my the scope of my talk this afternoon, but that, in that box there are about 200 sets of document. Ed Asner and my name is on the document. It consists of four articles of impeachment that I have drafted against President George Bush. I heard Mr. Madsen speak earlier about impeachment and the possibilities of impeachment. And those of you who are so inclined, I suggest you take these four articles, which sum up really the crimes, the high crimes and misdemeanors of this president. Take them, who are so inclined, take them to your local Congress people who are running for office in November. Perhaps make this a condition of your support for them, or your neighbors or your community support for them, that they commit now before November that they will support a bill of impeachment against this president. There is a progressive caucus, and they need all the support they can get. If the Democratic Party happens to get control of the Congress in November, then it is very likely that this bill will be introduced and it will go forward. Now, the important thing to understand about impeachment is that once it starts, it has a life of its own. The media have to cover it, and as the evidence unfolds, evidence about everything, not just 9/11, but the entire surveillance operations, the secret prisons, the violations of the Treaty of Convention on Torture, it all starts to come out. And when the American people hear for the first time what this government has been doing, because the mainstream media has never told them what it's been doing, it should be all over for this president. Some of you will remember the impeachment proceedings against Richard Nixon back in the 1970s, in 1973. You'll remember what happened then as it unfolded. Even his own party had to turn against him, and of course he was given no sway at all. He had to ultimately resign and then be pardoned. So impeachment is certainly a course of action. It is certainly a serious possibility. And Nixon's crimes, of course, are legendary. It is 33 years ago tomorrow that Salvador Allende went for the last time to Moneda Palace and said, "I will die here rather than let this fascist government come from the outside and take control of Chile." And as you know, on the 11th of September, 1973, Salvador Allende died in the palace, fighting Augusto Pinochet and the American lackeys who took over. In his last broadcast, the Chilean people, he said, "Make no mistake about it. It is all about the defense of our natural resources. That is what this is all about." Now, this is not a single issue. People have said, "What are you doing getting involved in a single issue like 9/11? This is not a single issue. This issue pervades the entirety of life, culture, politics in this country. This issue is an issue that involves the symptomatic illness, sickness of this nation. We live in the belly of a beast that has ravaged the world and the poor people of the world for the last 60 years. So I come here because my conscience compels me to come here, as yours compel you to come here, and as yours compel you to work, and as this panel continues to do its work. It is a matter of conscience, and it is for the salvation of this republic. So I celebrate you. I am not involved in the nitty-gritty day-to-day work of this investigation, but I celebrate you, and I celebrate these people for what they are doing. As citizens of a republic, you have to do what you are doing. You have to dissent. You have to work. You have to investigate. You have to clamor. Dear citizens, do not fall silent. Grow in numbers and grow in strength, and let your voices eventually be heard. Having said that, I don't serve you well unless I caution you. After over 40 years of experience and not a small amount of pain, there are five elephants in this room. And one of those elephants is military intelligence. And they're here. And they're recording them for themselves and taking the notes on everything that is going on here, and they will report back. And they're doing their job. And you know, some of those guys, when they get to fairly senior levels, have a conscience. And that, strangely enough, that conscience, and I think I heard Mr. Mattson mentioning contacts, often causes them to do things, to make phone calls, at least to tip people off. Seymour Hersh has been the recipient of any number of these kinds of good tips. I was told about the assassination plot against President Chavez on, it was going to take place on the 11th of April, 2002. What is this about the 11th day of these months? The 11th day of April, 2002. And he sent two ministers to London to meet with me for the first time. They didn't believe me. The coup, of course, took place. The second time I was given the tip, he did believe me, and the coup did not take place. All right, the second elephant in this room are provocateurs, disinformation agents. And they will seek to get your trust. They will seek to come inside. They will seek to work with you. And they will seek to have you proclaim the untenable, the undocumented. Yes, the very difficult aspects of your work will be to discern what is true and what isn't true. What can we substantiate and what we can't? Because the first times you make a mistake, the mainstream media will destroy your credibility. Make no mistake about that. You must be very, very careful. Now, the third elephant in this room, it's the corporate elephant in this room, is the corporate mainstream media, and they're here as well. Not that they're going to cover anything, or not that they're going to use anyone's names, or not that they're going to give any credit for the work that's being done, but they're here. And they have been well and truly had for many years. Carl Bernstein told us in 78, oh, there are 400 intelligence agencies represented in the mainstream of American media. New York Times had 12. Sulzberger gave Dulles, Alan Dulles, 12 in 1959. They've rotated over all the years. The largest publisher in the world is the Central Intelligence Agency, owning publishing houses, magazines, newspapers all over the world. So make no mistake about it. That's a pretty big elephant that we're up against in terms of information, and they're right here with us today. Now, the good news is that the other two elephants are truth, which underlies everything you're after and about, and which pervades everything that happens here today. Truth. The truth of what really happened in 9/11, what really took place, and what really were the actions of members of government and their outsourced mercenaries who are always present in these operations today. So truth is very important. And the overwhelming support of the people of this planet is here in this room. Remember, 84 nations lost their people in that event, 9/11, in that tragedy. And anywhere one goes in the world today, there's no question that the support for what you're doing and for the truth about that event is with you from around the world. Please do not ever, ever underestimate that. Now, there's not a lot of time, but it's important that you have this historical context. So I can only, in the time that's allowed, give you a bit of a snapshot. But it's important, I apologize to those of you who know all of this history, but many may not. And in order to understand exactly what happened in 9/11, and to put it in the context, it is very important that you understand this. It started a long time ago, didn't it? It started with the invasion of Mexico and the major acquisition of good chunks of southwestern America taken from the Mexican government. Yes, it did. And then it went in 1893 to Hawaii, where the native Hawaiian monarch was overthrown by 200 Marines serving the interests of some American sugar interests. Then it went to 1898 and the Spanish-American War, where America helped, of course, liberate Cuba, said it would leave, and then stayed, putting in one dictator after another, till the Cuban Revolution of 1959. Then we had the Philippines, where the Americans basically took total control with massive numbers of dead. And then we had World War II. And everyone said, well, that's a good war. We waged that war. Well, was it? Yes. A good war, ultimately? Yes. But what was happening all the time running up to that war in terms of the Nazis? The carriages that took the Jews to the camps were built by General Motors. The calculators that they calculated the deaths in the various camps were produced by IBM. John Forster Dulles was the managing partner of Sullivan and Cromwell. They had one of their largest offices in Berlin. They represented the major multinational corporations who dealt with Nazi Germany. The Bush family and its legacy dealt in banking and finance with the Bush, with the old man Bush, with the Nazis. So America's corporate hands are, as always, dirty with respect to collaboration, even with the Nazis. And then after the war, the entire Reinhard Gehlen organization was brought here, and American foreign policy against Eastern Europe was programmed by Hitler's own intelligence operations that we brought to these shores. Then we have the legacy of Mossadegh, brilliant, revered, secular leader of Iran, who was overthrown by the CIA, all having to do with Anglo-American oil. Then there was Arbenz in Guatemala, and that had to do with sugar. I knew Arbenz. I came to know Arbenz, one of his personal pilots, who was a CIA mercenary guy. And I said to him, Jack, at one point, don't you guys have any conscience about helping these kinds of tyrants and putting them in power? And he said to me, he said, Bill, it's a job. If I can do it for a good guy, I'll do it. But it's a job, and that's what we do. So that's what they did. So there goes Arbenz. Honduras, the same thing in 63 with Zamuri and the sugar. Roldos, the objectionable leader of Ecuador in 1981, was hit, had his helicopter shot out of the sky. The same year, Omar Torrijos, who was totally unfathomable and disliked to the extent that Chavez is today, Torrijos was then in Panama. His helicopter somehow got blown out of the sky. And in comes Noriega, who was a favored strongman for quite a period of time. Then, of course, there was Grenada, which was Ronald Reagan's magnificent victory, because, of course, the Cubans had some workers there, some technicians, helping to build a medical school. And that was, you couldn't do that. So yeah, they invaded Grenada. They didn't like that government. And more recently, of course, in Haiti. Ah, Haiti. They've blatantly gone, kidnapped the president of Haiti, and flown him off to exile in Africa. Jean-Baptiste Aristide is now ensconced in deepest Africa, having been kidnapped by American military forces. So that is a part of the background, but then there is Pakistan. Now, Pakistan is of particular relevance to all of you here, to all of us here. Particular relevance. And what the Brits call an old Pakistan hand. I spent a lot of time there in one way or another. I was Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's last lawyer on appeal before Zia took him out and hung him in 1978. Not one of the cases I'm particularly proud of. But anyway, they hung him. He was out of the way. Zia was running the country. He put the daughter, Benazir and Begum, the widow, in prison, then house arrest. And through one means of leverage or another, usually threatening massive public opinion and public relations, mostly from Europe, nothing from here, We got Benazir out and Begum out, brought them to London, and last time I became very friendly with Benazir, the last time I saw her in the Barbican in London, she said, "Bill, I'm going back to Pakistan." I said, "What are you, crazy? He's only going to put you in jail again." She said, "Oh, that's my father's destiny. I'm going back." She gave me this rubbish, right? So I shook my head, and you know, off she went. Within a short period of time, Zia's helicopter blew up. And guess who was prime minister? Benazir Bhutto, who then proceeded to loot the country with Asif Zardari, her new husband. All right, so Zia's away. Benazir is now prime minister. Over the years, there's no question in terms of what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan that Pakistani intelligence, ISI, worked very closely with the CIA and effectively created the Taliban. They created the Taliban. The Taliban were used to get rid of the Soviets. And they thought they could deal with these guys. Okay, so they bring them to Houston. And many of you may know the story. They came to Houston to discuss a pipeline, would you believe? That's what you do in Houston. So they discuss this pipeline. And were the Yanks surprised when the Taliban would not agree to the terms and conditions they wanted? And they said to them, in this famous quote, "We can carpet your country with bombs, or we can carpet your country with gold." And this is in June of 2001. So it's all building already. The Taliban, of course, go back, and the rest is history. Their country was carpeted with bombs. So ISI has this close, ongoing working relationship with the CIA. Now, I ask you, I don't know a great deal about a lot of the nitty-gritty individual facts that a lot of people have on this case, but I do know about this one. Why has Mahmoud Ahmed, who was the head of Pakistani intelligence, ISI, at the time of September 11th, in fact, here in Washington for seven days during that time, why, when he instructed Sheikh Obaid to send the last $100,000 to the alleged hijacker, Mohammed Atta, why? Why? And this is not questioned by anyone. The FBI has admitted that they know this. It's well documented and well established. Why has this man not been indicted and extradited to the United States to stand trial? And worse than that, why has there been no coverage of any of this? Why has the 9/11 Commission never even dealt with this? Why hasn't Tim Russert and Anderson Cooper and these characters, why have they not once raised this question? Well, that's a rhetorical question, isn't it? I mean, I think I think we know. This money rules this empire. It's the same oligarchic forces that killed Caesar, killed the Gracchi brothers, the same oligarchic forces that have tried to unseat Chavez and have hated Castro for so long, the same types of forces here have caused $400 billion to be spent in Iraq, have caused tax advantages for the wealthy, have cut back on social programs so that the tax benefits of the wealthy can be made up, and on it goes. I last time mentioned the story of a man who used to brief Lyndon Johnson on the Vietnam War, and I left Vietnam out of that litany. And he would come back every week, every 2 weeks, and he'd talk to Johnson, and he'd say, "Now, President, this is the wrong war. We must get out of this war. We're losing lives. We're spending treasure. This is the wrong war. This is a nationalist war. This is not a communist domino event that's taking place. This is a nationalist war." Johnson, listen, went on week after week. Finally, one day, Johnson pounded the table. And he said, "John, I can't get out of this war because my friends are making too much money." Now, that speaks volumes. And the woman who told me this was the daughter of the of the colonel, who was Johnson's briefer. She said he came home, her father came home that afternoon, told his wife to pack their bags. They were taking an he was going to have himself assigned to Canada, and he was going to sit this out. No longer would he participate in these deaths. But that revelation does say it all. It continues to this day. It is all about money. This must end. The Institute for Policy Studies has done a massive study on executive excessive incomes. Recently, it's just come out. He said the top 15 U.S. oil CEOs were paid an average of $32.7 million in 2005, in 1 year. William Greehy of Valero got $95.2 million. Ray Irani of Occidental Petroleum, $84 million. Lee Raymond, outgoing CEO of ExxonMobil, $69.7 million. These are annual pay packets that people are getting in a country where Congress is refusing to raise the minimum wage. This is a disgrace. You remember old man Welch confronting Joe McCarthy? You may not, if you haven't been go back that far or seen Good Night and Good Luck, confronting McCarthy, and he said, "At long last, Senator, have you no shame? At long last, oligarchs in America, have you no shame?" Is there no limit to this greed? Is there no limit to this greed? I think that's the answer. All right, so what to do? You know, what to do? What to do about all this? We now have an analysis of this problem. What do we do about this? I'm here to tell you what I think should be done, and it may not be of interest to many of you. I think it's the time for words are over. I think the time for speaking truth to power is over. Power doesn't listen when you speak to it. You know, during the Spanish-American War, our forebears had the best songs and the best speeches. During the Vietnam War, we had the best songs and the best speeches and the most righteous people. And we fought a losing battle. I will tell you what I think has to be done. Just look south of the border and you'll get a glimpse of what AMLO is doing in Mexico City. When they control the electoral machinery, as they did in Peru, as they did in Florida, as they did in Ohio, apparently, and as they certainly have done in Mexico, why they limit the machines in the poor areas, and they cause people to wait, and they threaten them, and they take them off the rolls, and they find reasons not to allow them to vote, and then they stuff the ballot. They go the whole range of things that causes elections to be lost. When they do that, and one knows that, and one says, as Obrador said, "Let's just give us a recount. Give us a recount, and then we'll agree with you, but we have to be a part of that recount." And they say, no, recount is necessary. So AMLO has said, all right, then we are not going to do what the Americans did in Florida. We are not going to do what the Americans did in Ohio. We are going to come and we are going to stay. In 1967, 39 years ago, Martin King said, "Bill, the only way to really move this government is not by marching, and it's not by talking, and it's not by appealing to their conscience. The only way to move this government is to confront them with the other means of power. Two roads to power, one, money, they have that. Two, numbers, we should have that." So, what Martin proposed in 1967 and was unable to carry out in 68 because they killed him is what I'm going to suggest that this growing organization consider doing now. My suggestion is that you build a camp Then we go to Washington, D.C., and we build a camp. And we build this camp in the shadow of the Washington Memorial, and we stay there. And we go every day to the congressmen and the senators and the various districts who represent us with a very simple demand. That demand, that goal unifies this whole group, because everybody here I know wants that goal, that demand. That demand is, give us a new independent investigation of 9/11. One that has subpoena power, one that includes family members of victims of 9/11. And you go every day, and you darken their door every day. And you go every other day, and you keep going, and all the time you're there. You see, if you march, they can count on you going home. But if you go to stay, that's another matter. And when you plan this, and the logistics are very important, do not go and say to the parks authority, we want to come and we want a bit of land where we can put some camp, some tents, and we want some ability to be here for a period of time. We're not quite sure how long, but you don't do that. You don't do that. You say to them, we are coming. We are going to be here. We want to work with you in terms of where we're going to stay. So work with us, but make no mistake about it. We are coming in our thousands. And all of you and all of the workers and all of these people are important, but amongst that group, for the security and safety of that group, must be people who are known internationally, who must come from various countries of the world. Entertainers must come. People have got to give up portions of their time and be there. That is the security for everyone else if you have those kinds of figures. And by the way, it's time that all of our dear old friends who write so well, who analyze so well, it's time they came to the streets, because this republic is dying. John Milton told us, you know, we all have one foot in the grave, and we do. But what this is about is those who come after. What this is about is, what are we leaving those who come after? And that is not a single issue. That is an issue, an affirmation of an issue forever. You know, as a young baseball player in Cuba, two of us came from Colombia into Cuba in 1959 after the revolution. And Fidel's a baseball fan, a very good pitcher, by the way. And as is Chavez, both left-handed, and I was a left-handed pitcher too, so we have that sort of in common. But there was always a shy guy in a lot of the meetings, in a lot of the rooms. And he stayed off to the side, and it took a while to get to this guy. You know, eventually, his plea would be heard throughout the world. Jean-Paul Sartre called him the most complete human being of our time. He would shake the earthly foundations of oligarchy wherever he went. And he had this magnificent phrase that he coined, por los pobres de la tierra, hasta la victoria siempre. For the poor people of the earth, ultimately, victory. We have to strive for victory for the poor people of the earth. And that was where he always saw things. Ernesto Che Guevara. Yeah! 175 years earlier, Mr. Jefferson noted that man is the only predator who preys on his own kind. The rich, he said, upon the poor. And how right he was. But he said, you know, went on to say, we should not expect to be transported from despotism to liberty on a feather bed. I suggest there will be no feather beds in this camp that I'm proposing to you. Indeed, we may ultimately confront Mr. Jefferson's greatest reality, that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. He said, this is its natural manure. So we must see 9/11 as the excuse for the despotism that is involving our world and that of the world. The time has come for the American tree of liberty to be refurbished, to be refreshed. Your precious work and all of this has made a beginning. We've made a start. If it stays with words, if it stays with publications, if it stays with wonderful documentaries of the truth, it too shall all pass away. If you want to change this world, if you want to change this nation, if you want to save this republic that is moving ever closer to empire, then you have to take that kind of action which I suggest here today. Hasta la victoria siempre, for the poor people of the earth.